This is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. There's no doubt about it. Trolls, bots, and misinformation on online platforms have become a major issue to contend with, particularly whenever election season rolls around. And when there isn't enough quality content out there about a topic, purveyors of disinformation will be there to fill in the gaps. That's what has become known as a data void, and it can be an even bigger problem for Spanish-speaking audiences. If political candidates are slow to realize the differences among Latino voters, it turns out that those spreading disinformation have caught up fast. In this episode, I spoke with Claudia Flores Saviaga, a Facebook fellow and PhD candidate at West Virginia University. Her research focuses on how bad actors organize these disinformation campaigns online and how to use artificial intelligence to try to stop its spread. She explains how disinformation targeting Spanish-speaking populations works and why being a troll is a lucrative deal. Thank you for being with us.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Thank you so much, Claudia, for being with me today. I want to start off talking about your research with data voids. So let's just assume that a lot of our listeners have never heard of a data void. What is a data void?
Well, the term data void is actually new. It was coined in 2018, just before the midterm elections. And it was coined just thinking about search engines. But right now we are researching data voids on social media. And when we say data voids, we try to describe this information that it's not on social media, because the topic is either limited or non-existent. Therefore, it can be used for political trolls or bad actors to weaponize these data voids to create content to push their agendas.
Great. So can you give me a specific example of a data void that you've seen and that probably others are might even have heard of in 2020?
Yes, for example, the topic that started as the pedophilia problem with Joe Biden, it started in the social media in English, and then it caught attention in social media in Spanish, especially around Florida and around Miami area. And that was something that was circulated a lot. So what happened is that a lot of the Latino community started thinking that it was true. And the problem was that nobody was contrary to that information, trying to create the story that it was not true. So the same happened with the QAnon conspiracy theories about George Soros and the deep state, that George Soros was behind all this conspiracy about 5G and why they wanted to control us. So these kind of things might sound crazy, but people might not have like enough information to be more informed.
So it's essentially kind of the idea is the information starts to spread, the misinformation starts to spread, and there isn't any correct information to stop it. So, you know, in our world of media outlets, we see online fact-checking by media outlets and things like that. But in these pockets where these data voids, there isn't that content to sort of say, no, this didn't happen and correct that misinformation.
Exactly, because this is something that is not created organically. So it's not just that a lot of people are creating just because they got the news or they wanted to spread, but it's something that could be like a political agenda behind, but also it could be like for monetary reasons, because research has shown that these kind of stories that are super like sensationalist, they are more prone to people to want to read it just because of the sensationalism. Also, this creates like a lot of economy behind that, because if they get clicks, for example, they could get ads on the web page, and that creates an economy. So it's not only political reasons, but also economical reasons. And that makes them more prone to be created in mass.
That's incredible, because there's an economy of misinformation in that case. So looking at the U.S. election, can you give me some examples of data voids that exploited Latino voters, that tried to take advantage of the Latino voting bloc?
Yeah, it was something that I researched a little bit during this electoral period. And what I saw was a mass creation of this post that were trying to link Joe Biden with the socialism discourse. And what was interesting is that it was also not organic. And what I saw was like a big disparity on this post. I didn't see anything on the other side. And that was worrisome because it's something that really caught attention on people. And that might give you a false sense that actually that's something that it's true. So this might get into the mind of the voters, and that's something that might change their vote behavior.
One thing that we hear a lot is that the Latino vote should not be treated as this one block vote. That, you know, obviously Cubans in Miami are different than Latino voters in the Southwest, and even maybe Latino voters in California. So were you seeing examples of differences in this misinformation targeting these different Latino audiences?
Yes, and that was something interesting that I also saw. That it, as you say, we are very different, even though we are all Latinos, but we are triggered by different things. So maybe the Cuban Americans might be triggered by the socialism discourse, but not the Mexican Americans. So for example, in the Mexican American case, what I saw was a lot of posts that were trying to link Biden with Mexican businessmen that were corrupt, or even ex-presidents that were corrupt, that I saw a lot of pictures that were circulating about that and trying to do that discourse with them, so trying to dissuade them from voting for the Democratic Party.
Arguably, the biggest issue for the Americas would be the pandemic. And we know that as this has spread so quickly, the pandemic, there has been misinformation about the pandemic. It's hard to get correct information, especially initially. And we know that if we're going to look at the Americas, whether we're talking about the United States or we're talking about Latin America, we're talking about countries that have been particularly hard hit by the pandemic. Are you seeing data voids, or have you seen data voids with a pandemic? And I'm also curious if you've seen an evolution at all with that, given that we're now well past 6 months into the pandemic.
Yes, that's something that we started to see when everything started. We realized that there was a lot of information circulating in English. And that became a problem with the Latin community that didn't speak English. And we started to realize that they were lacking this type of reliable information from the reliable sources. That was one of the reasons why all these conspiracy theories started to get into their minds, because they didn't have anything to rely on. So what we found is that one of the good ways to tackle this is just to create information that has some reliability on it. So we started working with it, for example, to translate all the posts that came from the research or the news media that is reliable, that has helped us to counter this problem. And it has been an evolution, because every day the media started to just get accurate information about the pandemic, about how it was transmitted, about what was the measures that were better to be safe. And that's something that has been going on, especially in Latin America. But also it's important that, for example, governments are aware of it and they can have the population informed about all the research and what is true and what is not, for them to have more options where to get information and reliable information.
It looks like we have a couple of issues here. One is getting information that is correct in Spanish. So in the case of the pandemic, the information came out, initial research was coming out in English, and it wasn't getting translated fast enough. And then the other is filling the void with information that's correct. I mean, that sounds like a huge challenge. Have any platforms or governments found a way to do that and to accomplish combating this information by filling the void, essentially?
Well, it's not the only solution. This is a complex problem, and that's why a lot of governments, for example, in Europe, have treated this information like a national security problem, Because it's not something that it's only on the side of the platforms to solve or on the side of the society. We need to work together, even with governments. The internet or the social media platforms are like any other tool that you can use. You can use it for good or you can use it for bad. And that's why it's up to who is behind that tool that it's responsible what they do with it. But also the governments have to step in the sense that, for example, if you have a gun, it's illegal just to kill somebody because you want to kill somebody. But also, I think that this information should be treated also with laws in the sense of what do you do with the information that you're publishing? Are you publishing massively to create harm? That's type of questions that a lot of governments are starting to ask themselves, but also we step in the discourse of free speech. Until which point there's a line in what is free speech and what is something that could cause harm offline.
It seems also as though this is an area where I imagine the trolls can respond and react. So governments are trying to potentially pass a law and then the goalposts shift. So with that in mind, and looking at things that you're seeing now, what are some concerns or worries in how trolls are adapting that you see coming on the horizon? What is the next thing to worry about in terms of misinformation?
Well, it's something that it's always has happened since I started studying this, is that every time that either social media make changes in the algorithm to try to stop disinformation, trolls adapt because they can adapt. So they change their behavior. Let me put you an example. Before, it was very easy for them to create massive number of accounts on Twitter. So they started to post the same messages on Twitter again and again and again. What Twitter did was just create these algorithms to detect that. Say, okay, if this person tweets 30 tweets per hour, that might indicate that it's something automatic, so we can block them. But what they did is that they created this mix of humans and bots or automatic accounts. So there's a human behind the account that tweets like a normal person and then just create these tweets. Just instead of 30 per hour, they can manage to do it one per hour and then modify a little bit the message and then do it again and then modify the message and do it again. And this makes Twitter not be able to detect them so easily because it's hard to distinguish what is human and what is not human.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Who are these? Who are these people doing? Like when you say, so there are actually people behind this, you know, in the context of, you know, you're Mexican, and in the context of Mexico, we always think about Peña bots from the 2012 election. But there are people behind some of these accounts. So who are these people and where are they coming from?
It's what I told you before. There could be many reasons for this. It could be political reasons, maybe because it's a way to reach society organically, just in where everybody is, that it's social media. Or there could be also people that are trying to spread misinformation for economic purposes.
Mm-hmm. One question I have is that you talked a little bit about some of the misinformation and data voids leading up to the November 3rd election in the United States. Now we obviously have a result in which President Trump has been reluctant to concede. Is misinformation continuing? And in particular, how is it affecting sort of the Latino voting bloc since the election?
Well, it's not only something that has affected the Latino vote, but democracy overall, because right now this information that is circulating is that the election was stolen. So that's something that I've seen a lot that also social media platforms have tried to stop. But it's something that it's circulating like there was a fraud in the election. For example, the people that voted, maybe their vote wasn't counted and stuff like that is something that I've seen a lot. We are going to continue to see it because there are high prominent people that are spreading it because they truly believe that.
Mm-hmm. So that's part of the problem is influencers themselves.
Yes, it's a big problem, the influencers, when they spread this misinformation just for the reach of the accounts. If they have millions of followers, obviously they're going to have like a huge reach.
Mm-hmm. So for those of us who are looking at the information, one thing that we've been hearing now for years is that we get into our own bubbles and we get into our own echo chambers. How do we break through those? What do you recommend to people who are on social media and reading this content? Because even if you're not reading crazy things about pedophilia rings, you can still be influenced by the echo chamber that you're in. What is some of your advice for people to avoid disinformation and to come to these online platforms and recognize when they're getting incorrect information?
Yeah, we have to get into social media with an open mind, just because what you say about the echo chambers, it is true that people tend to read what resonates with them. So it's important to also have like the other point of view even in social media. Even I follow accounts that I don't agree with, just to know what they are talking about. And also check the sources, not only the sources of who posted, but the sources of the sources. Right now, there are a lot of social media outlets that do their own fact-checking. For example, Associated Press does a lot of that. And I think it's important to also follow the story, because that's the only way in which we can have like this critical thinking and really question ourselves about what is or what is not true.
Claudia, thank you so much for joining me. This is really interesting. I've learned a lot about data voids.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis, and this episode was produced by Katie Hopkins. The music in this episode was recorded at 680 Park Ave in New York City. For more about concerts online, go to musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can help us spread the word. Give us 5 stars, share, and subscribe at Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.